doing wonders for their branding, actually, mm-hmm. that it isn't just the Palestinian cause that they're focused on.
So call a ceasefire now and end the positive branding. If you want to stop the Houthis doing what they're doing, then call a ceasefire right now.
Do you genuinely believe that the Houthis would stop doing what they're doing?
They have literally said that that's why they're doing what they're doing. They have not previously blocked those routes. And I also think the West needs to start to understand that you cannot just go around playing cowboys in the world. There are consequences to your actions. You cannot just go around bombing people's countries, ignoring international law, and expect no repercussions. For every cause, there is a consequence. And just because you don't like a couple of guys trying to resist,
I mean, these
the fact
are
that this is
now prescribed terrorists.
Sure. According to Western governments,
well,
they are
also
terrorist
according
governments.
To the
these people are creating a total trade blockade, which is causing inflation, which is causing all sorts of problems to everybody.
25,000 people are dead in Gaza right now. There are over 60,000 people injured with no access to food, water, aid. How dare we have a conversation about trade when there are children right now being treated without anesthetic?
Well, the
there are things that require us to make some sacrifices, and this would be one of them.
They do have the global economy, global markets hostage.
Good for them. Bill Browder. Good for them. Cease fire now. Cease fire now.
We're going to have to leave it there. But Dr. Miriam
Francois. You cannot allow these people to be decimated and expect there to be no consequences.
But there seems to be no better reason or statement than looking at economic figures to show who succeeded in implementing their will in the Red Sea. Previously said that about 15% of the volume of global maritime trade and 30% of the world's container traffic passes through the Gulf of Aden, the Bab el-Mandab Strait, and the Red Sea. Also, the costs of maritime transportation through the Suez Canal have increased due to the crisis in the Red Sea. The port of Eilat in the Gulf of Aqaba, which was actually the main goal of the Yemenis to prevent commercial ships from docking in this port and put pressure on the Israeli entity, has faced an 85% reduction in activity, and half of its employees are on the verge of dismissal. The Zionist regime had high hopes for the development of the Eilat port, especially to participate in China's so-called One Belt, One Road initiative, to the point that their heavy joint investment with China in this port and even Chinese investment in several other infrastructure projects in the occupied territories caused Donald Trump to strongly protest the Zionists, resulting in a decrease in the level of cooperation between the two sides. The famous economic institution J.P. Morgan announced the recent incidents in the Red Sea have caused a 1% increase in global inflation. On the other hand, shipping costs, especially the increase in time required to travel through alternative sea routes, and of course the increase in the cost of marine insurance, in addition to the increase in the cost of personal wages, in addition to the delay in the arrival of products to specific destinations, have all been among the obvious and hidden economic costs of this conflict. On the other hand, Egyptian officials of the Suez Canal have also announced an increase in the passage rate of between 5 and 15%, which itself increases the total costs. Some ships that have chosen the route around the African continent and the Cape of Good Hope must also face very bad weather conditions in that area in southern Africa on the one hand, and at the same time, an increase of several days in delivery times of cargo on board on the other. For example, the cost of transporting a container from Shanghai, China to the port of Rotterdam, the Netherlands, on a normal route that crosses the Red Sea in February last year was about $1,000. While in February of 2024, this figure increased 6.5 times to $6,500 per container. What Yemen has managed to do is that at least a significant portion of the world's population, especially those living in capitalist countries, has been looking for reasons for these price increases due to their increase in the costs of goods and services, and has become more aware of the pain and suffering of the oppressed people of Gaza and Palestine. But what has received much attention is the cost that the United States and the West are paying to counter Yemeni missiles. They are destroying threats that are much cheaper in terms of price with expensive weapons. For example, several media outlets have highlighted the use of a standard $2 million missile by the United States Navy to intercept Yemeni drones that cost $20,000. These statements are rooted in truth. Air and missile defense interceptors are relatively expensive. Budget documents for fiscal year 2024 show the U.S. defensive missiles are in total almost twice as expensive as offensive missiles. When average unit costs are calculated, U.S. offensive missiles are probably more expensive than the Yemeni offensive missiles. In any case, after more than a year of conflict in the Red Sea, and even looking at the conflicts in the occupied territories and northern borders with Lebanon, we see the resistance forces have gained a certain self-confidence, much of which is due to the heavy pressure exerted by the Yemeni resistance in the Red Sea against the Zionist entity and its Western and Arab supporters.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IranRadio.ir with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have been discussing the major concept of taqlid in Islam based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei for several episodes now.
Yes.
And let's continue along this subject. And let me ask you at the beginning of this episode this question. And that is, you know, well, whenever we speak about taqlid, we mean follow a religious scholar.
Yeah.
Well, when we follow a religious scholar, one of the characteristics of this individual that we follow should be just, as they say.
Yeah.
Would you explain a little bit about this and elaborate on it, please?
Well, we do know that, first of all, mujtahid should be male. Okay, some of the conditions or requirements of a mujtahid is that the mujtahid must be male, he must be baligh or mature, he must be Shia Isna Ashari, he cannot be a Sunni, for example. He should be, of course, legitimate by birth, okay? Mm-hmm. Because, for example, someone who was born out of adultery cannot be a mujtahid.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he is a mujtahid, no one else can follow him. And then the last one, which is very important, is that the mujtahid should be, of course, just, okay? Adil, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to the concept of adala, it is important because if the mujtahid is not just, he may be attributing false things to the Prophet and to the Imams and claiming things which cannot be trusted.
Mm.
So someone who is adil, he does not lie, actually. He does not fabricate things. He tries to be honest and to deal with his followers honestly, giving his fatwa based on his inferences from the Quran and the Sunnah. He does not amalgamate things with
mm-hmm.
each other, with his own opinions, and then conveys his opinion to the people as those of God's opinion or those of God the prophets. So that's why it's important that at the mujtahid be just, because he can be trusted,
mm-hmm.
and people will rest assured that he is giving the religious actually opinion
mm-hmm.
to his audience, and not those of himself, his own.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are delving into is still the concept of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, one of the frequently mentioned or cited words in the area of jurisprudence is precaution or ihtiyat. Would you please elaborate on it?
That's good. Ihtiyat is divided into wajib and mustahab, okay?
Yes.
And ihtiyat simply or literally means precaution. Some of the translators have used the word caution, but I think the word precaution is a better word to suggest that the mujtahid does not have a fatwa. He has not reached a conclusion,
yes.
and therefore he is exercising precaution, ihtiyat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he is advising his followers also to follow the same line of ihtiyat or precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So there, sometimes he says, okay, alal ahwati wujuban, and alal ahwati wujuban is a term that denotes obligatory precaution. So obligatory precaution means that, okay, the mujtahid, that the precaution itself is wajib,
yes.
okay? There is no fatwa, but that very precaution is necessary to follow. But sometimes ihtiyat is mustahab,
mm-hmm.
and which means that, okay, the duty-bound person can choose not to follow this mustahab, precaution. He can follow another mujtahid. So in terms, generally speaking, when it comes to ihtiyat, of course, every duty-bound person is free to act according to that precaution or to follow another mujtahid.
Uh-huh.
another mujtahid, not every other, in every another mujtahid, yes. there are many mujtahids yes. who may not be qualified for taqlid.
Mm.
So when the mujtahid says that you can refer to another mujtahid, he means the next most learned mujtahid.
Mm.
Yes. So it's then becomes difficult for the duty-bound person who the next most learned mujtahid is.
So
okay?
how can they understand
yes.
it?
It's very difficult. When you ask the mujtahid himself, who is the next mujtahid, most learned mujtahid,
yeah.
he will not give you, he will not answer you, because he says, it's not my duty to say who the next most learned mujtahid is. You have to ask, let's say, the fuqaha, the students of the Islamic
mm.
seminary, and you have to go to the hawza to see who is reckoned to be the next most learned mujtahid. So it is the duty of the duty-bound person to identify the next most learned mujtahid. Generally speaking, the mujtahideen themselves do not announce such
things. So even if, as you mentioned, that if you refer, for example, to some seminary schools, Islamic schools,
yes.
and you ask, for example, some of the scholars over there,
yeah.
and they will, or the clergies, they will tell you, for example, this one or that individual, and then they couldn't, what do you call it, reconcile them, for example, one single individual. So what would be the situation?
Okay.
How would you go about
if
it?
If two, according to the scholars, if two witnesses testify that, okay, a certain mujtahid is the next, or he is the first mujtahid,
mm-hmm.
okay, he is the most learned mujtahid, the most
yes.
knowledgeable scholar,
mm-hmm.
and then the next person who is the next most learned mujtahid is such and such person, okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If two just witnesses
mm-hmm.
testify this, it is enough,
I
okay?
see.
It's not necessary to ask different people because there are maybe contradictions. Two individuals might consider a certain mujtahid as the next, and then there could be another person. So it's not necessary to put yourself into unnecessary
mm.
trouble. Okay.
I see.
If two people who are students of the Islamic seminary and
I
who
see.
Are faqih, who have studied and who have close knowledge of that mujtahid, testify that he, for example,
mm.
that mujtahid is the most learned or the next most learned,
yes.
then that's enough.
And you don't need to trouble yourself
yeah.
for deep investigation.
Deep
okay.
investigation.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the very subject of taqlid, and based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, we know that the duty bounds should follow a religious scholar.
Yes.
Or the most learned mujtahid, right?
Yeah.
Well, when it comes to that, sometimes you see that some duty bounds follow some dead religious scholars. Is there any problem with this if you follow dead religious scholars or deceased ones?
Well, it is not permissible according to the religious authorities and His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei to
mm.
initiate taqlid of a dead mujtahid. Okay,
uh-huh.
By the word initiate, I mean that it's not permissible to start following a taqlid from the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you have now turned 15 years old,
mm-hmm.
and you're looking for a mujtahid, and okay, some people might suggest that you follow a dead mujtahid. Okay, you have no idea of, because you are not very much rich in terms of your knowledge.
Yes.
So you might start following a dead mujtahid. That's not permissible. It's not permissible to start doing taqlid of a dead or a deceased mujtahid. Okay. Now, if you are following a deceased mujtahid, you are following a mujtahid.
Yes.
But then that mujtahid died.
Died. Yeah.
Of course, it's now your duty to see whether he is still the most learned mujtahid, or probably there is another mujtahid who is alive, and he's better qualified, he is better eligible. Now it is you again to look for that. If you think and if you come to some conclusion that the deceased mujtahid is still the most qualified, the most learned mujtahid,
mm-hmm.
then you should remain in taqlid of that mujtahid with the permission of a living mujtahid. Okay?
Yes.
You should go to him and ask his permission. Okay, if he gives a general ijaza or permission to his followers, telling them that, okay, to the mu'mineen, telling them to remain in taqlid of that mujtahid, then they can remain. Okay?
Mm.
It's not necessary for every individual to go to that mujtahid and and seek ijaza or permission in person. Okay?
Yes.
And that's not sometimes possible.
Okay.
So I forgot to mention there was another thing I forgot.
Okay, let me ask you this question here, just to squeeze in because we don't have much time till the end of the program.
Yes.
And that is, you said initially you cannot follow a deceased mujtahid, right?
Yes.
Or a religious or a scholar. But what about the other ways that it is possible actually to follow a deceased mujtahid or religious scholar?
Okay, if you are already following him, then you can remain.
That's the only way?
In taqlid of him. That's the only way, of course. And you will need to get the permission of a living mujtahid. And when it comes to some new issues, okay?
Yes.
Because the dead mujtahid might not have a fatwa about the current legal situation.
Yes.
Okay? And when there is no fatwa and you cannot find his opinion about that particular issue, then it's necessary to follow another living mujtahid in that regard. Okay, and that living mujtahid must be the most knowledgeable of all the living mujtahids.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on Iran Radio .ir. With me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker, and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun majaa ilaha illahum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun basirun
Black and white. En América Latina, incluso en España y en algunos otros países,
in Latin America, as well as in Spain and a few other countries, a phenomenon has emerged that some scholars refer to as illegal warfare or lawfare.
Algo nuevo.
This concept is considered new by these scholars, perhaps because they overlook the fundamental structure of states. States cannot be divided into parts where one part controls the other.
No se pueden dividir por partes y decir que una parte está para controlar la otra.
A state is a unified entity with essential pillars such as the armed forces, the judiciary, and the parliament.
Fuerzas armadas, la corte o poder judicial, parlamentario.
All working together to uphold the model of society that state has.
Ese estado tiene. Entonces, es algo sorprendente.
So it is somewhat surprising that the elitist courts at the service of the dominant classes in Latin America act against those who maintain political positions of a democratic nature. Progressive in the good sense of progressivism, a healthy progressivism.
Progresismo que no tiene nombre nada más. Es algo que alguien podría llamar la atención.
We're not talking about that progressivism that has no name. Is this not something worth noting? At some point, an oppressive state is supported by boots, by the military, at other times by ballet shoes, by the courts.
Con lo que son las cortes judiciales. A través de las cortes judiciales se van.
Through the courts, government, like Cristina Kirchner's in Argentina,
Rafael Correa's
in Ecuador, and Lula da Silva's in Brazil, have faced challenges.
In Brazil, y otros lados. Es algo entonces que debemos de tenerlo en cuenta.
This is something we need to keep in mind. The fight for social transformation must encompass all aspects and carry all banners. A state resembles an octopus with tentacles that control the entire situation. One of those arms, a very strong one, is the judicial power. A judicial power that looks inward and reproduces itself in an undemocratic way. Even in Latin America, many courts have seen little change except for the passing of judges who were part of the era of military dictatorships that plagued our region. Can anyone truly believe that justice exists as a common good for all? This isn't just about social justice. Of course, it also has to do with that. This does not exist. Just as it is necessary to change the nature of governments in relation to the armed forces, the character of the judiciary must also be transformed if we want sovereignty, independence, and development in the peoples and countries of Latin America. Let no one be fooled. The judiciary is not neutral. It is not merely a counterbalance to the executive and legislative powers, as some legal scholars claim. That perspective belongs to academia and those who support the system. But it has little to do with the practical realities of people's lives. Lawfare is a tool that I have also seen used by imperialism that targets social and political leaders who are striving for change. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. La forma de ejercer el poder, los estados.
The ways in which power is exercised by states have always been multifaceted. They utilize military, economic, and legal means. Sometimes military force is the primary method for addressing issues, while at other times, legal avenues are pursued. Currently, due to various contradictions, particularly the weakness of popular movements, it's not the military that is taking charge, but rather the so-called soft coups through legal warfare or lawfare, as it is known. To discuss this topic, we have a special guest from Argentina, Silvina Romano. She's a prominent researcher and academic, serving as the coordinator of the Lawfare Observatory, which focuses on the study and analysis of judicial warfare in Latin America. With a doctorate in political science, her research primarily examines the relationships between the United States and Latin America, along with issues related to democracy, security, and the use of legal strategies as political tools. Silvina Romano, welcome to Black and White.
Bienvenida, Silvina Romano, a Negro y Blanco.
Hola a todas y todos.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What characteristics has this hybrid legal war, known as lawfare, taken on, Silvina? It would be great if you could help us understand where the term comes from, especially in the context of Latin America. How does it manifest itself?
The main point I want to make is about how the judiciary, particularly its Supreme Courts, shapes political dynamics. How does this happen? There are numerous legal actions taken against certain political sectors, leaders, and parties that have a chance of winning elections. By filing these lawsuits and bringing them to the media's attention, it creates a sort of spectacle around these legal accusations, effectively preventing these individuals and groups from participating in the electoral process. This is the general idea. Where does this concept originate? It seems to define the current situation. It's a term used in the United States, originally coined by an American military figure to describe how soft power tools, rather than force or weapons, can be employed to intimidate opponents and persuade them to withdraw from their struggles. One of the key tools in this context, known as lawfare, is particularly noteworthy. Economic sanctions play a significant role in shaping international relations. They can be used strategically to influence countries like Iran and Venezuela, and to severely impact economies such as Cuba's, ultimately aiming to undermine their sovereignty and force compliance. This is a broad overview of the situation. The focus here is on how the judicial system and media power are leveraged to marginalize certain political groups, effectively removing them from the political landscape. As a result, when you go to vote, your options are limited because these individuals may be facing legal issues, imprisonment, or preventive detention. Consequently, the judicial system, along with media and social networks, shapes the political agenda.
La agenda política.
¿A ti no te parece que también es un poco?
Don't you think that there are also some misconceptions among liberal sectors when a democratic struggle for workers' rights and social change begins? They often overlook the fact that the judiciary and courts are crucial pillars of the capitalist state, which in many Latin American countries are heavily influenced by U.S. imperialism. Additionally, these judges operate without any popular oversight. For instance, in Chile and likely in Argentina as well, judges have not been removed. Instead, they have been replaced using the same methods, and we still see the same courts that date back to the time of Pinochet's fascist military dictatorship.
It seems you've hit the nail on the head regarding the issue at hand. Among all branches of power, the judicial system is arguably the least democratic. Just think about it. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, how often did we discuss the judiciary? Not very much at all. Back then, it was largely unknown. Now, names like Sergio Moro ring a bell for many of us, especially since he gained notoriety for imprisoning Lula. In the last couple of decades, we've witnessed a significant rise in the visibility of the judicial system. We see them on TVs, we hear about them on the radio. Why is that? Because it is taking over the agenda. We are talking about a highly conservative right-wing judicial power, as you pointed out. Why? Because when it comes to these courts, there is no replacement. Why is there no replacement? Because the judicial systems often represent our oligarchies or privileged minorities. Becoming a Supreme Court judge isn't just about having a good law degree. It's more about families and a sort of corporate network that perpetuates itself within this power structure. They reproduce themselves. It's important to note that while the judiciary has always influenced government decisions, it didn't have the same level of visibility and presence that it does today. Take someone like Diana Salazar in Ecuador, for instance. She's in the news every day. Remember what I said about Sergio Moro? They become celebrities in the political arena. This shows how the media and the judiciary are increasingly intertwining with politics, leading to a distortion of what politics should be.
That's right, Silvina. We'll take a quick break and be back in just a moment.
Estamos de vuelta acá con Silvina Romano.
We're back here with Silvina Romano. Silvina, you were sharing some insights about the interplay between the dominant media outlets and the interests of big capital, which the states in Latin America are part of, essentially the owners of this big capital. You also mentioned the role of the media and the courts. There is an intriguing aspect to consider. The courts often present themselves to the public as neutral entities. They project a somewhat saintly image, suggesting they rise above politics and contradictions, solely focused on delivering justice. But what kind of justice is that? Are they truly neutral, or do they serve political interests? Who appoints the judges?
It's important to highlight that every branch of the state is inherently involved in politics. The state is fundamentally a political organization. So to claim that it is apolitical is quite a simplistic way to describe any governmental power. It simply doesn't hold up. What we should focus on is that these powers should not be tied to any specific political party. Ideally, they are meant to deliver justice impartially. But why is that the expectation? If we consider that these judicial elites represent a privileged minority, we must ask whose interests they truly serve. Are they representing the interests of the people? It's worth noting that much of the political persecution through the judicial system has been against progressive sectors. So what do we mean by progressivism? Governments or political sectors that advocate for state intervention in the economy aim to redistribute resources for the historically marginalized minority in Latin America, particularly during the 1980s. So what do these minorities represent? They don't represent or care about the everyday people. It's not a matter of being good or bad. It's about serving other interests. They cater to corporate agendas and belong to families that lead transnational lives, existing in a world far removed from that of ordinary citizens. They are not interested in judicial processes related to, let's say, battered homes, abandoned, or battered children. No, that's not what motivates them. Well, what drives them then? Their focus is on supporting large corporations and, above all, hindering processes where the state is taking over. To what end? To define and redefine concepts like sovereignty, autonomy, and the redistribution of resources, particularly those that are strategic in nature. To what end? To define and redefine concepts like sovereignty, autonomy, and the redistribution of resources, particularly those that are strategic in nature. The judiciary is politicized, favoring a privileged minority. Okay, now here is the question. Where do our judges receive their training? I'm not sure if I should continue, but it's crucial because most of the training often comes from regional organizations like the OAS, Organization of American States, or they attend courses in the United States. It's not that these programs are inherently bad, it's just that they are the available options that can help advance one's career, and that's widely accepted. The real question is, why should the framework and action plans for our judicial systems, judges, and prosecutors come from the United States, when the needs and history of our population are so different? Exactly, this seems to be one of the key issues worth discussing.
It's similar to the relationship that the armed forces of our countries have with them. The United States train military officers and also judges. Everything is interconnected, like a giant octopus with various arms. Look, López Obrador attempted some reforms within the constraints of liberalism, particularly in the judicial branch, which is a significant aspect. In Venezuela, at the local level, there is also a process for the direct election of judges, specifically at the parish level. However, in Mexico, the situation was more complex, with strong contradictions arising. The judicial branch strongly opposed these changes. What can you share about that effort to alter the nature of the system, even though the fundamental nature can't change without a shift in the overall system?
I believe it's positive on two fronts. One aspect is the democratization of the judiciary. And I find the experience unfolding in Mexico to be quite fascinating. Initially, the focus was on reducing the privileges of the court, which had exorbitant salaries and outrageous benefits in a society marked by significant inequality. I think they have rightly placed their attention on this issue, and it's a positive step forward. Now, the question is, what does this minority in the judiciary represent? We find ourselves in societies that are extremely unequal. If we don't address the structural inequalities, no matter how many reforms we implement in state powers, we will continue to sustain a privileged minority that survives inflation, neoliberal policies, and the selling off of nations. This group manages to survive. The issue with our judicial systems is that they perpetuate these structural inequalities. In other words, the privileged minority within the judiciary reflects these disparities. We can work towards democratizing this power by allowing people to vote for judges, but we must also change the underlying structural and economic conditions. There needs to be a shift in the relationship between the structure and those in power. How do we achieve this? It seems to me that this is somewhat what is being attempted in Mexico.
Así es. De acuerdo a eso,
That's right. It's very hard for the people to have control over the courts if they don't have control over the entire state, given the very nature of a capitalist state. Can we say that lawfare also highlights the limitations of liberal democracy? It's definitely a topic worth discussing, isn't it? It seems like liberal democracy is often seen as a quick fix for everything.
Es una pomada que arregla todo.
I find it incredibly interesting to focus on this issue because do you know who is revealing the limits of liberal democracy? It's the rising far-right movements that are coming to power through democratic means. This situation highlights the limits of liberal democracy. It pushes progressive sectors to define what democracy should truly encompass. Simply going to vote isn't enough. We need democracies that are substantive with economic, political, social, and cultural inclusion, elements that the far right in Argentina, especially influenced by Trump, are currently rejecting. The judiciary is one of the branches where these far right groups stand firm, as they are part of the broader right wing agenda. So I think the challenge today is to give substance, to give flesh to this democracy, and to recognize that what Latin America needs is social justice. Without social justice, it becomes challenging to discuss democracy in a meaningful or profound way.
That's right, we have elitist courts that obey the elite, and they see this as just. For them, it feels justifiable because they view our current situation, filled with inequalities, exploitation, discrimination, and widespread poverty across our continent, as normal. Which cases of lawfare have caught your attention the most in Latin America? One or two, perhaps?
Uno de ellos, o dos, no sé.
El de Ecuador. Me parece que Ecuador.
The one in Ecuador. I think the one in Ecuador seems to be less visible compared to the Lava Jato scandal in Brazil, which received significant attention and is indeed important. The one in Ecuador in recent years has been a total persecution against Correism, against any political sector that doesn't kneel directly before the de facto power of the United States, which wants to make Ecuador one of the economic and military bases of operations in the region. What's happening is quite serious. The state is undergoing rapid deinstitutionalization. There's a scorched earth tactic at play, allowing cartels to operate freely, which creates a dire situation of poverty and makes it nearly impossible for young people to build a decent life. This has resulted in a wave of Ecuadorian migration as people are forced to leave their homeland due to a lack of dignified living conditions. The narrative justifying these actions has been framed as a fight against corruption. No, let's not be fooled. Corruption is a significant issue faced by governments around the globe. In Latin America, the real challenge lies in structural inequality, a lack of investment, and inadequate infrastructure. There are people living in conditions reminiscent of the 19th century, and while we will address corruption, we must also recognize that many children are going without a meal each day, thousands in our countries. We need to prioritize these issues, as the left has always advocated, equality first, access to a decent life, and then we look at all the other issues, right?
Perhaps one example of what you're suggesting about Ecuador is the situation with the embassy. How did that go unnoticed and the courts remain silent? And now, in practice, the vice president's dismissal.
Absolutely. Take a look here. I'll also share the link to the book, Lawfare in Ecuador, War Against Democracy and Law. It details the case of Jorge Glass, who is recognized as a significant example of lawfare on an international scale. The Ecuadorian government disregarded legal boundaries and international diplomatic norms without hesitation. This sets a concerning precedent as it jeopardizes the right to asylum for everyone, which is extremely serious. And you know what happened? We're working to ensure this issue gains attention in international organizations and resonates widely. But Jorge Glass remains imprisoned, unjustly and illegally.
Jorge Glass sigue preso.
The camera is set aside, the courts are quiet, and everyone is in high spirits. Silvina Romano, we have reached the end, and we truly appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here on Black and White.
You're very welcome, and thank you. Let's keep fighting together.
Así es.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
In the limelight. The
Trump administration on Friday, 28th of March, asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene to allow the government to continue to deport immigrants using the obscure Alien Enemies Act. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The United States has ordered consular officers to significantly expand their screening processes for student visa applicants, including through comprehensive social media investigations to exclude people they deem to support terrorism. Coming after several high-profile visa revocations and targeted arrests over pro-Palestinian campus activism, a State Department cable from 25th of March obtained by The Guardian describes a new standard for visa denials based on a broad definition of what constitutes support for terrorist activity. The directive states that evidence that an applicant advocates for terrorist activity or otherwise demonstrates a degree of public approval or public advocacy for terrorist activity or a terrorist organization can be grounds for visa rejection. It specifically targets new and renewing F, M, and J student visa applications, providing explicit instructions for consular officers to conduct mandatory social media reviews, digging into applicants' lives online. Officers are directed to examine the social media of all students applying to a visa for evidence of activities the administration defines as a threat to national security or terrorism. The directive mandates that fraud prevention units which received flagged applications take screenshots of potentially derogatory social media content, creating a permanent digital record that can be used to deny entry into the United States. Those officers are instructed to preserve screenshots to the extent it is relevant to a visa ineligibility and upload them to the applicant's case record, even if the posts are later altered or deleted. The memo sent by the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, says evidence that an applicant advocates for terrorist activity or otherwise demonstrates a degree of public approval or public advocacy for terrorist activity or a terrorist organization may be indicative of ineligibility. The statement adds, this may be evident in conduct that bears a hostile attitude towards U.S. citizens or U.S. culture, including government institutions or founding principles. The memo says the vetting process should extend to students in the United States as of 7th October 2023, whose visas are up for renewal. In recent weeks, the U.S. government has revoked the visas of a number of students it claims have expressed support for the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Continue with The Guardian's coverage of this story. The new procedures are certain to prompt concerns that social media posts supportive of the Palestinians that contain critical commentary on U.S. foreign policy or that indicate attendance at a campus protest could trigger a comprehensive visa review. The cable does not require visa denials to be predicated on explicit support for any specific group, and goes beyond traditional security screening, allowing officers to investigate an applicant's relationship with organizations including current membership, financial contributions, or other forms of support. The State Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The new order lands amid an already intensifying crackdown on pro-Palestinian activists nationwide. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Thursday 27th of March said he had revoked more than 300 visas targeting students connected to campus protests. The latest example is the capture of Rumeysa Ozturk, a Turkish Fulbright scholar at Tufts University, who was detained by plainclothes agents wearing masks in broad daylight. The updated screening process references two of Donald Trump's early term executive orders, focused on foreign terrorists and combating anti-Semitism. The memo reads, "Every visa decision is a national security decision." National Public Radio, NPR, has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Trump administration on Friday, 28th of March, asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene to allow the government to continue to deport immigrants using the obscure Alien Enemies Act. The request came just one day after a federal appeals court upheld a Washington, D.C. federal judge's temporary block on immigrant expulsions via a wartime act that allows the administration to bypass normal due process, for example, by allowing people a court hearing before shipping them out of the United States. Friday's emergency request claims the federal court's order temporarily blocking the removal of Venezuelans forces the United States to harbor individuals whom national security officials have identified as members of a so-called foreign terrorist organization bent upon grievously harming Americans. Donald Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act has spurred a legal battle between the executive and judicial branches of the U.S. federal government. Lee Gellert, in a statement on Friday afternoon, said, "We will urge the Supreme Court to preserve the status quo to give the courts time to hear this case so that more individuals are not sent off to a notorious foreign prison without any process, based on an unprecedented and unlawful use of a wartime authority." Lee Gerent is the deputy director of the American Civil Liberty Union's Immigrants' Rights Project and lead counsel in the case. As the executive branch of the government continues to battle the constitutionally co-equal judicial branch for primacy, the U.S. Justice Department said in its filing on Friday, 28th of March, that the case presents the question of who decides how to conduct sensitive national security-related operations, the President of the United States or the judiciary. The Justice Department wrote, "The Constitution supplies a clear answer to this question, the President. The Republic cannot afford a different choice." On 15th of March, Donald Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act, a wartime statute allowing the U.S. government to expel foreign nationals considered to be enemies of the United States. When invoking the act, Trump, without proof, claimed that the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua had infiltrated the United States at the behest of the Venezuelan government. A U.S. intelligence document accessed by the New York Times contradicts Donald Trump's claim about the Venezuelan government's ties to the gang. That day, attorneys filed an emergency motion to block the use of the Alien Enemies Act to expel migrants to El Salvador. Then planes took off from the United States, transporting the nearly 300 immigrants accused of being gang members. As the planes were in midair, a federal judge in Washington blocked the use of the Alien Enemies Act to expel the immigrants.